Hey there. We at Blue Wire just wanted to take a second to thank you for listening to this podcast. We know everything outside is pretty scary and uncertain, but we're committed to helping you get through your day by talking about the sports and teams that you love most. If you're looking for more great podcasts to distract you, check out BlueWirePods.com. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the podcast and stay safe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the B-Ball Index podcast. My name is Tim. I'm Krajicnik Basketball, your host for today. This podcast, again, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcasting Network, and this week's episode brought to us through our sponsor, betonline.ag. So this week, we are talking WNBA draft with Ben Dahl, my favorite WNBA writer, who is still churning out some great WNBA content over at the B-Ball Index, even as the sports world mostly halts. Including Ben's recent mock draft and big board piece over on the WNBA draft, which is still, you know, of all the things that are halting, the WNBA draft is still churning along. It'll be happening this Friday, the 17th of April. Very much looking forward to it, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being on. I think we definitely need to, I mean, at B-Ball Index, we're all about the numbers and the data, and a lot of it's been around NBA, and we've been trying to get more college basketball in there, and you've been turning out great WNBA content for like over the last year. So definitely want to give you a chance to hop on the podcast, and I think we'll talk about a big current event, get into some more general draft questions, and then really want to, you know, poke and take a look at the recent content that you've turned out around your mock draft and the big board. I have some questions around that, but I think one thing that we can start with is the recent Tina Charles trade. So just to give people some context here, the New York Liberty gave up Tina Charles and they got the 12th pick from Washington and then the 9th and 15th picks from Dallas, as well as Taylor Hill from the Wings and Walker Kimbrough from the Mystics, as well as Washington's second and third round picks for next season. So they got quite a bit back. The Liberty now have five of the top 15 picks in Friday's draft, I believe, including the number one pick overall. The Mystics got Tina Charles, adding on to what was already a championship winning team. And then Dallas gets Washington's first round pick in 2021, New York's second round pick in 2021. I don't believe I missed anything, but there were a lot of pieces in here for, you know, three of the 12 teams, and we can talk a little bit about how the trading dynamics are a little weird in the WNBA with fewer teams available. But Ben, just in general, what are your thoughts on this trade and what it might signal for the teams involved and what they're looking to do in the next season or two?
Yeah, so to start with Tina Charles, you know, really one of the dominant players of the decade, and she's going to be 32, and there's no reason to think she doesn't have a few years left at a pretty high level. This was clearly a case where she just realized she was finally ready to move on. The Liberty cored her, which is the league's equivalent of the franchise tag. So, you know, they had her in this holding pattern and they had to figure something out. And it had been for a few years now. You know, the Liberty were a lottery team these last 2 years. They really fell off and just didn't have the talent to compete. So clearly, on some level, Tina had just kind of decided, hey, maybe I should try to go win a championship. And I think people kind of wanted that for her even earlier than this off season. And Washington's obviously a great place to pick. And clearly, you know, she was going to narrow it down. She wasn't just going to go anywhere. She wasn't signed yet, so they had to work with her. And she played for Mike Thibault in Connecticut. You know, Mike's one of the best coaches in the league. Obviously, there's one. They had coming off a historic offensive season. Like, they're obviously going to put her in a position to succeed. And really with New York, it's just you got to get what you can, right? You salvage it as best you can. And I think I wonder if there's maybe a little too much PR, you know, in saying it's, you know, five of the top 15 picks and whatnot. And just, you know, if you're getting a late round pick, it just, you know, maybe you get a bench player out of that. Maybe you can land a starter, but it's not an awesome haul, all things considered. But they had to do something.
Mm-hmm. And I guess another way to look at it would be from New York's perspective, understanding the dynamics at play and you know, Tina's own desires to win a championship. I guess they're also looking at where she is, not just with her legacy and what she's done since she came into the league in 2010, but what she's bringing to the table right now for a non-contending team. You're always in a tough position. Do you stick around with that vet who, you know, might be able to sell some tickets and is a familiar face and name, or do you try to turn that page? And like you said, it's not an outstanding return, but there are a lot of pieces involved. So we'll see what they're able to make out of that. Maybe this gives them more flexibility moving forward. But just from a if we're going to infuse a little bit of data in here from a player impact plus minus standpoint, so that PIPM stat that we use at B-Ball Index, we have it for NBA, WNBA, college basketball. This is a plus minus stat showing how impactful a player is per 100 possessions. It looks at the box score, and it also looks at the play-by-play to understand the dynamics of, you know, when this player is in with these teammates, it performs this much better or worse than that same lineup with a different player in. It looks at lineup strength, opposing team lineup strength. So there's a lot involved with that. And through Tina's career since 2010, she's had 7 different seasons of impact that we'd estimate as all WNBA caliber. But also by PAPM, you can see that, and also in a couple other stats as well, these past couple seasons, she's kind of dropped off. You talked about how she's in her early 30s. And even these last 2 seasons, by PIPM, she's been a below average total impact player. And I mean, she's still certainly a great person to have around. She's had a better offensive impact than defensive impact. But the advanced data suggests that if you're still able to get some return for her, you might want to pull that trigger now, especially if you're going to be paying her at the core price tag. So I think that's another thing to take a look at with this. But, you know, you talked about the PR around the 5 picks for the Liberty in the top, among the top 15. Do you see any opportunity for them with those picks and where they're positioned to be able to have some sort of quick turnaround the way that the Aces did from 2 years ago to last year, going from the fourth worst record to the fourth best record? Certainly it's a different circumstance. You're not adding the same known value that the Aces did last season, bringing in an MVP candidate. But is there that hope that the Liberty can sell their franchise and fans with having that many picks? Is it realistic to think that they might be able to have some sort of future from this draft that's happening in 2 days?
No, not just with the stuff that they got. It would take a number, you know, a really high pick in a future draft to really land another star caliber player. Because now the thing with New York is you're looking at their front court and it's like, what's the plan? You know, they got Amanda Zawabe and Hanju, 2 stretch centers, but how impactful are they defensively? They're not necessarily like slam dunk, you know, lock them in for a long time. And Kia Stokes, more of a shot blocker, not as much of a threat offensively. And then they just have nothing at the 4. I mean, they have no one right now. You know, Rebecca Allen is like a wing who can slide up and, you know, she can shoot. So you can maybe open things up. So they really have to address their front court. And their backcourt situation is fantastic. You know, they're in a great spot there, but they need to, you know, they need to kind of just figure out what the direction is up there to complement those players. And just, you know, it's probably going to take a star, you know, star caliber player that has that impact on both ends to really get them in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about star players, how many, maybe this year or in an average draft season, if we're talking about the first round, how many, you know, all-star caliber players might we expect to see out of those 12 picks? Is it probably only the top couple, 2 or 3 between like 0 and 5? I don't know how consistent it is year to year, but at what point do we drop off from, hey, these players might be stars, to here are some starters, to here are some bench players, to, you know, these are more dart throws In the NBA, I'd say in the lottery is where you're getting a high majority of those starters and star type players. And then in the second round, you have a lot of dart throws, and you'll get some, you know, bench guys and eventual solid starters in the late first round, maybe early second round. But what does that look like in the WNBA, especially having three rounds?
Right. So I'm looking at, I put the last decade all on a sheet here, looking at it right now. And number six is where you can kind of draw a pretty clear line, where that's kind of a point where a lot more players may just not make it or just wash out relatively quickly. And, you know, you can, you can define star differently, but, you know, kind of the way I went through it, you know, two to three per class, plus a few more, you know, really solid starters is a pretty normal year. So that's that kind of comes in with New York here. It's like, all right, you've got 9 and 12, but, you know, one, you probably need some help, or maybe some teams above you really whiff and then just, you know, maybe you still get lucky there, but that's where it's the thing of, hey, and we have all these picks, and obviously the NBA, it happens too, right? And you just overvalue while it's the unknown. But then once you find out where it actually is, it's like, okay, you know, like the NBA, where it's teams have picks that turn out being in the late 20s. And, you know, obviously it's not as big of a value proposition.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're talking about, you know, those future war chests and the hope or possible upside of future year picks, it becomes a little bit different current year. And then once those picks materialize, and we've seen that in the NBA with teams like the Celtics kind of being sold internally on that own war chest of assets, and then it not materializing perhaps as they'd planned, especially compared to potential offers that they may have had on the table for different calibers of players throughout the years. So moving, any final thoughts about the Tino Charles trade? Or if not, I'd love to get into just a couple other quick questions about, you know, for many of the listeners who are perhaps more familiar with the men's game, how this draft and what they might see on Friday might be a little bit different from what they're used to.
I would just say on Tina Charles, it's such a big part of the numbers the last couple of years. And I would strongly caution anyone of reading too much into that. Look, her field goal percentage has been bad. Like last year, especially, it just wasn't good. And such a big part of that was just the team wasn't good. They, you know, if you had aspirations of them being contenders, I'm sorry, you were just wrong with what they were putting on the court. They weren't going to get there. Now, the thing with looking at Tina's game specifically, you know, she's 6'4", she's really strong, and she is an awesome low post player. And so much of her career, as you mentioned, she's been that high impact player. A lot of times she's the four playing with a non-shooting center, you know, so she's doing a lot of this work where it's not, you know, four awesome shooters around her, which she is going to have all the time in Washington. It's going to totally change the game for her. And it's just going to be much more of a matter of, hey, you know, take the right shots. And Washington's in a position where, like, hey, like if you're taking bad shots, like they'll just put her on the bench, because we'll roll with the lineup that won us a championship last year. So I think that, yeah, that adjustment will come pretty easy.
Is, I guess my interpretation of this from the Washington point of view is, even if Tina isn't able to return to that awesome form we've seen, they're not really losing much from what they just had from last year. So it's not a very high risk move for them. It's more of a veteran add that has some upside if she's able to return to what we might expect her to return to based off of her physical condition and what we've seen her do in the past, and just given a better circumstance, a better situation. If she's able to produce more efficiently, maybe pick it up a little bit on that defensive end, like that's a great vet add to, I don't want to say push you over the top, because they already went over the top this past season, but keep you at the top of that mountain, which can be so difficult. Is that how you see this move for them? One of those, you know, great opportunity, relatively low risk because of what they already have on the roster, and so, you know, some moderate to high reward.
Right. I see very little risk to this for them. Shatori Walker-Kimbrough is a good rotation guard. You know, she can play. She was their backup point guard for them in the playoffs last year. She produced, but, you know, I think that's kind of what she's going to be. The number 12 pick, probably wasn't even a lock to make their roster. They couldn't have known obviously who they were going to get yet, but just that low in the draft, it's just, and then the pick next year, we'd have to get into some kind of wonky kind of solution if we got to the point where there wasn't a season, and if we roll a 12-sided dice and it comes up one, you know, I guess that really burns you, but I don't really see a scenario where that pick ends up being even a lottery pick where maybe you kind of regret that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So that'll be an interesting factor for the draft on Friday, some of those picks swapping hands. As we talk about the draft in a more general sense, one thing that's really changed the game on the men's side over recent years, and we've seen this evolve over time, is the one-and-done players who are in high school, they play one season in college, and then they're right in the NBA. And a lot of these years, we see, you know, half or more of the lottery players as freshmen or maybe sophomores, and not as many of those third and fourth year players. How does that compare to the WNBA draft? And to what degree do you think that changes the game when it comes to, you know, boom or bust potential and us knowing what a player brings to the table just because of their age and how much more tape we might have on them?
Right. Well, one for, you know, people that want to be a pundit and whatnot, it narrows the pool down a heck of a lot, right? Like in the WNBA, you have to turn 22 in the year of your draft to be eligible to declare early. So, you know, a redshirt junior, maybe even a redshirt sophomore, you can kind of be in that position where you're old enough. And then an international player, someone born, so born and playing over internationally, you have to be 20 in the year of the draft. So that's a little bit of a different conversation. But with college players, yeah, you're seeing them for 3 and 4 years. So in a way, the picture is probably a little clearer going into any given year of whatever it might be, the top 6, top 10, top 12. You know, you're just going to know a lot of those names. And there can be situations where, you know, maybe it's looking at them too long. You know, players might get dissected a little too much. You know, we had last year where Arike Gumbawale and Nafisa Collier went 5 and 6. And, you know, if the draft gets redone, there's just no way they fall that far. But, you know, for the most part, yeah, it's, you know, those players are going to kind of rise to the top. And I guess in a way it does make the process a lot different, where maybe it isn't quite as much about upside. And you would think for the most part, you're going to see it if they're playing for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think it changes the dynamic. It maybe adds a little bit of a security blanket with some of those picks, knowing just a little bit more of what you're getting. There's always risk, of course, but an interesting difference between the men's and the women's game. One other difference that I wanted to cover, because it's been such a hot topic on the men's side, is the idea of tanking. And, you know, we see teams in the NBA who they decide, you know, as an organization, we don't have a chance to compete for a title. And we think we'll probably be, you know, maybe seventh to eighth, I don't know, in our conference. So instead of that, we're going to sell off some of our better, you know, older players, try to acquire some assets, be a worse team, be, you know, very bad, get a better draft pick. Hopefully we'll see how the lottery turns out. Whereas in the WNBA, 8 of the 12 teams are making the playoffs, and it's a 32-game season. And then I'll let you explain the way that they are doing their drafts, positioning and lotteries. So at least from what I've observed over the past couple seasons of paying more attention to the WNBA, as I've gotten more into it, it seemed as though there isn't as much of that overt, like, we've decided as an organization we are going to lose now, just because so many teams are in the playoff hunt for as long as they are. Is that perception, as someone who hasn't covered it as closely, aligned to what you're seeing? And can you explain a little bit more about how the draft positioning is determined, and you know, how that might impact the way strategy takes place in WNBA?
Yeah, I think there's a couple pretty massive pieces that goes into that. With how the lottery odds work, it's they take your 2 year record. So your record from the past two seasons. So, and Atlanta this year is a perfect example. They went 8-26 last year, but the year before, the year prior, they were a top four seed. They came pretty close to making the finals. So if you fall off 1 year, whether it's injury or, you know, you lose a player, whatever it is, Atlanta had the fourth best odds and they got four. Of course you could jump up, but it's taking those 2 years. There isn't quite as much maybe immediate incentive to really bottom out for a year. And the ownership part comes in here too, of course. And just, you know, the business is just so much different, right? To expect of an owner to tank in the WNBA. I mean, they gotta get fans in the seats. So to really take mm-hmm. like a aggressive, you know, Sam Hinkie approach, like, I don't think we're ever going to see that. Of course, if that person wants to do it, you know, and they're cutting the checks, of course they could, you know, do whatever you want, but I don't think we'll quite see something like that. And when it comes to trading star players too, it's a little bit different, you know, just like, you know, we obviously do have the case where a star player can ask out, but yeah, I would think it's pretty fair to say as a sweeping statement, you're far less likely to see a WNBA team proactively move off of a star player to get somebody else. But the last I think big piece to also mention too is just the consolidation of talent. You know, a 12-team league, it's just the star talent is more clustered together, so you might have more cases where it's just a trade might not fit, right? And use Tina Charles as an example. You know, would she fit, quote unquote, fit with every? Obviously, she's still really good, but she, you know, I don't think there's that same fit with a bunch of the contenders where they can just say, yeah, bring her on, and they can just make it work. Washington was a pretty unique circumstance where their bigs can all shoot it, and they can really, you know, absorb her and amplify her strengths relatively easily.
With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, they're bringing Vegas to you. Missing the NFL? No problem. BetOnline has live, daily Madden NFL 20 simulations you can bet on. You can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. All open 24 hours a day and all online. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution.
Yeah, it's an interesting difference, and a great point with the business side of things. It's something that, you know, is obvious in retrospect, but get really thinking about like this is a strategy with the rules and the standings didn't even come to mind. So thank you for pointing that out. I think those are all the more general questions. Now, you know, we can really dig into some of the great work that you've done with the, what is it, mock draft 2.0, 3.0, and the big board that you've put out recently. So I guess the first thing I want to talk about is on that big board, you have a former Oregon player first, and a current, I don't know, question mark, you know, season's over, Oregon player second. And then in your mock draft, you flip that order. So how close in each of those two lists or rankings is Ionescu to Satu Sabuli, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly?
Right. Satu Sabuli declared early for the draft. She's a junior. And Sabrina Ionescu is a senior. She's been the long presumed number one pick, and she was seen as the number one pick last year. She would have come out to Vegas. And with that, you know, I think one thing that came into play huge there was just New York being the team sitting at one. You know, it's so easy to mock Sabrina at one and not think about it because they just so desperately need someone to just seize control and take the reins of that offense. I mentioned they're in a pretty good spot with their guards, but they don't really have a lead guard. They don't have someone run a bunch of pick and roll, make all of our decisions, get us into our stuff, and just, you know, be a steadying hand. That's the one thing they absolutely just didn't have at all. And with Satu, it's, you know, having her a little bit higher, it's just, you know, she's a six, the toughest commodity to come by in the WNBA. She's a 6'4" forward who can handle. She's fluid. She's a good, she's a really good shooter, you know, mid high 30s from three, you know, pretty decent handle. I think there's some big upside there where she can kind of, she'll be able to really take people off the bounce and size them up. So it's just kind of, you know, it, in a way it's kind of a toss up, but, you know, versatile forwards really ruling the league. And you, I think it's a little bit easier to just plug Satu in anywhere, which I think was a point I had in there, versus maybe there could have been a team where they look at Sabrina and say, yeah, we're pretty set with our lead guard. And maybe we might, there might be a few cases, you know, not that there'd be a ton, where Satu might make a little more sense in an average year.
Gotcha. Okay. So you feel pretty solid about Satu going first to New York, I believe is how you had it, right? Sabrina going first, and then you had Satu in your big board as a little bit ahead, just right. From an overall neutral environment kind of standpoint.
Yeah, it also comes kind of down to where you kind of draw the lines and separating tiers of the class, right? I had my first grouping of the first three with Kennedy Carter as well. And just looking at those three as, okay, those are the three, you know, we talked about finding stars earlier. I think those are the three that you're looking at as these are future all-stars, multiple-time all-stars, multiple-time all WNBA kind of players that you really don't want to miss out on.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any question at three when it gets to Atlanta, or they're just taking whoever's left over of those three? Or I'm sorry, Indiana, not Atlanta. Indiana.
Yeah, Indiana's interesting. It's been very quiet. They have a new head coach, Marianne Stanley, and Tamika Catchings was officially named general manager. And maybe I've brought it up too much. You know, I'm willing to admit that, but I just think Kennedy Carter is going to be that good to where they definitely need to think about it. They're a team where they may feel good about where they're at with the guards enough where they maybe bump Carter down a little bit. They've got Erica Wheeler, made the All-Star team, and then Kelsey Mitchell, who was the number two pick in 2018. And then Lauren Cox, the name who's coming up there, who I had right below that, at ranked number four, as kind of an identity play. You know, they have Candace Dupree, who's been their starting power forward. She's gonna be 35. So it's the idea of, can we, you know, it's defensible for sure. It's, hey, we're gonna plug in this forward. She played high low at Baylor all the time with a similar player. She can make those passes. We can let her make decisions at the top of the floor. She does need to kind of prove it a little bit, you know, as a stretch big, that she's going to make enough of those shots to kind of make it easier to be that high-low playmaker. But she's really long, and just, you add Lauren Cox to Tierra McCowan, 6'4", 6'7", just barricade the rim. And you know, that's very clearly something that they can really, really build around for the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'm excited to see who lands where. I know that in just looking at a couple mock drafts, you had, you know, some slight differences at the top, but when we get into some players who it looks like you're seeing some extra value in, or maybe have seeing others maybe overrating Beatrice Lompremier from Miami, and then Jocelyn Willoughby from Virginia, are two players that stuck out to me as ones that you had a little bit higher than the consensus. So in those two players, what is it that, you know, others may be overlooking in their games that you see as either good fits with where you put them, or just, you know, these are better players and they should be drafted higher?
Yeah, to touch on Willoughby, I think that's a little quicker. I don't even think I'd say I'm necessarily much higher on her than the consensus. You know, it was a big leap to put her at the end of the first in a mock draft, but that was more just looking at it as Phoenix picking at 10 and Seattle picking at 11. Are they really going to carry six bigs? You know, would they really take a big there? I think that's where a lot of mocks have gone. So it's just also, you know, later in the first round, I think that's a point where you just look a little bit more at just what you know, what, which player at a, which position can somebody actually make the roster? That's mm-hmm. where I just think, so I think that was maybe not as much going out of limb per se. Whereas with Mon Premier, on one hand, I just, you know, there's a lot of, I think people have a lot of fair questions. She had a foot injury and missed a bunch of the conference season this year. And in a way, I wonder if maybe a little bit is too, a little too much ado about nothing, where it's just, oh, a big player got a foot injury. Is that, you know, is that a permanent black mark? I don't know. Obviously what teams know will be important there, but Beatrice at 6'4", you know, and maybe some teams view her as a 4'5", just as a 5. I've been kind of looking at her more as a 5, but she can really run. I mean, run the floor. She looks great. 15 feet, she can put on the floor, 1-2 dribbles. She's really smooth. She's got to add some polish, and she's got to at least have the 15-footer, and hopefully she can shoot the three a little bit. And I just think weighing that against maybe a backup wing, a backup point guard, I think that's, I guess I've kind of come out a little rosier on Mon Premier.
Mm-hmm. And just looking through your big board and your mock draft, I think you do a really good job, you know, identifying. I could see where the versatility shines through in some of the players. I love how you broke it out by tiers. I think that adds a ton of value and understanding where there may be a little bit more movement depending on fit. And so, yeah, I would highly recommend everybody take a look at that over at B-Ball Index. Moving away from those players that we've touched on already, are there any other big storylines, either with individual players or with specific teams, that you want to highlight going into the draft?
Yeah, I think the big question is whether we see another trade. And Dallas was the team everyone was circling. You know, before this Tina Charles trade, they were holding 2, 5, 7, and 9, and it was like, all right, that it seems unlikely that all these players can make their opening day roster, and they end up moving 9 in the Tina Charles deal, which was a good move by them, by the way, to kind of just kick the can down the road. You have a pick for 21 now. That's going to probably be more valuable in future trades, right? Than more of a known commodity now in 9. So with 5 and 7, you know, I don't know, is Indiana or Atlanta, would they have interest in trading down? Does Dallas want to move up? A lot of people have tied Dallas to Lauren Cox because Lauren played collegially at Baylor, grew up in Texas, so maybe there's the local angle, and the thing everyone's kind of dancing around or bringing up very quietly is obviously Dallas has been through a lot the last couple of years. Liz Cambage and then Skylar Diggins-Smith, 2 all WNBA players, have asked out. So bringing up the local angle, and Kennedy Carter played at Texas A&M. She's also a Texas kid too. So, you know, how much does that really matter to them? Is some of that noise? I don't know. And if they end up doing something there, maybe we'll find out. But if just whether Dallas is done dealing or not, you know, they're I think they're kind of at the point where you kind of asked about New York, you know, kind of springboarding. Dallas is kind of at that inflection point now where they clearly, you know, they made out great getting Arike Ogunbowale at 5 last year. She is, you know, unguardable one-on-one. She's going to live in the lane. Like, that's someone that can just make a ton of plays for you. If you get Satu Sabally at 2, as most people seem to agree, you know, at least on the mock draft side, that's where you go. That could be a number 2 scorer, really versatile forward, open up the floor. You know, and then, you know, if there's one more big move here, I think you're suddenly looking at Dallas as, you know, they might kind of be the next team to really rise.
Yeah, and they and the Liberty probably have to, I would say that they definitely have the most draft capital in this draft with 6 picks for the Liberty, 4 picks for Dallas, and 3 of those 4 being in that first round. So, like we said, potential springboard there. When we look at some other teams that maybe springboard, or I guess looking at it more from the player standpoint, are there any players outside, let's say, the top 10 that we should keep an eye on that we might be hearing a lot from, you know, whenever this next WNBA season does happen, when things get a little bit back to normal? Who has the most upside, or who would you say is somebody that you're keeping a close eye on that might make a lot of noise when the season does start?
Yeah, I think this is very, well, for one, Makia Herbert-Harrigan out of South Carolina, she's you know, kind of in that range, maybe even a little higher than 10 or at 10, but you know, she's a little on the small side, really skinny at 6'2". So can she really be a four, you know, against bigger, you know, 6'4" bodies, stronger players? But she's somebody that I could totally see, like, if you just plug her in, you know, ask her to move her feet, block shots, spot up, make shots, like a rotation player, I definitely see that, the outline of that for her. But as far as upside, I mean, this is probably a little subjective. Maybe some people are just totally out because, again, you know, if you've seen somebody for 3 or 4 years in college and, you know, it isn't starting to pop, you probably, it's natural to ask some questions. But Joyner Holmes out of Texas, you know, just she's a truly elite athlete, and those words probably get thrown around a little too loosely, but, you know, Joyner really is an awesome athlete. 6'3", you know, if you as a four, I think a lot of people envisioned her as an Alyssa Thomas type player who hopefully, you know, people saw in this past finals, just grab and go, can put it on the floor, get into the lane, create matchup problems, and just really strong. Joyner's long, she's athletic. It didn't really come together for her at Texas. And, you know, is some of that system, is that college having the defensive 3 seconds where, you know, in the pro level, the game changes, right? The lane is going to be so much more open. And can she get with the coach that'll kind of believe in her and just, you know, help her with her finishing, her handle, her effort on defense, and just really simplify things for her. And maybe you can slowly build on that. And that might be the player that we're looking back on as, you know, quote unquote steal.
Mm-hmm. And just looking at the notes that you put into the big board, your last sentence on her is teams just may not have room for more of a project. And I think that's a theme that's come through a couple of times with just the roster spaces available. And it appears as though, just to me, from a drafting standpoint and draft strategy, fit is something that's so important. And, you know, you don't have a G League. You don't have the, you know, larger rosters to be able to hold somebody, give them a couple of years, and then hope they pan out. As much you're hoping for more of that immediate impact, and Joyner Holmes may be somebody who falls victim to that just because of where her skill set is today and the polish that you're looking for her to put together, that, like you said, we didn't see as much as we would have liked from in Texas. So I think that's another interesting dynamic, looking at the WNBA compared to the NBA and understanding how it compares to, you know, other leagues in the world. And in the NBA, you don't have too many, like, you're not going to get like a star player in the G League, but you'll see teams like maybe like the Spurs, who they get a Bryn Forbes who turns into a very, very solid role player for them, who they're developing in the G League. Is without having that developmental opportunity on the WNBA side, I think it almost comes to their benefit that these players do need to spend as much time as they do in college, so that there's, you know, less of, I don't want to say margin for error, but less of a range of outcomes with some of these picks, because then you won't have as many, you know, players flaming out and busting because you have a better sense of what you're getting just because, you know, again, you don't have that safety net as much to let somebody develop, you know, on the bench or in a minor league or something like that. So lots of interesting aspects at play. Another thing that you had mentioned to me that I want to touch on is the idea of players falling, or maybe that falling may be even more important in the WNBA than the NBA. Again, when it comes to this idea of fit, you know, right player on the right team for them might be 2 or 3 picks lower than they possibly could go. For the NBA, again, you've got that G League, but then again, you've got rookie salaries kind of locked in by position. And then in the second, or at least early first round, and then in the second round, you stop getting guaranteed money. So there's still some wiggle room, but you don't want to overdo it. You don't want to get too cute because you might lose your guaranteed money, or you might fall out of one of those higher value lottery spots. What does that look like on the WNBA side? I think we've seen from the team level, and we've seen this in your analysis for who might pick who, it can be very important from on the player side, how much wiggle room do these players have? And do you have any good examples of how that might materialize, or how they might try to frame themselves heading into a draft to find a better situation for them?
Yeah, I think late first round again is a perfect thing to bring up. Herbert Harrigan, one, and then Ruthie Hebert, Sabrina Ionescu's pick and roll partner at Oregon. You know, Ruthie was high 60s from the field, and they just totally carved people up because it's four round one pick and roll, and teams truly had to pick their poison. Sabrina is that good of a pull up shooter. She is going to hit every pass, whether it's skipping to the weak side, a pocket pass to Ruthie, just whatever it is, she was able to make every single read. And Ruthie was really good in her role, but she's listed at 6'4". She's probably a little smaller than that. So, and you know, she's not much of a stretch player. So if you're looking at her as a center, she's undersized, and you know, the game will just look much different for her at the pro level. You know, she's not going to be a mismatch in the post like she was against virtually all of her college opponents to go score on them. And, you know, she's, you know, if she's trying to be that pick and roll finisher, well, she's going to do it against 6'6 Sylvia Fowles, 6'8 Liz Cambage, 6'8 Brittany Griner. You know, it's just, you know, you're going to be against running into bigs, even if they're in a drop coverage where it's just, they're going to straddle that line between the two players so much better. It just won't look the same for her. And yeah, I bumped her down to the early second round because, yeah, it's like, you know, I mentioned Phoenix and Seattle. You're going to keep a sixth big. And of course, you can argue whether, you know, in Phoenix cases, especially, maybe if they should cut one of the vets they have for one of those young players. But like Seattle, you know, a lot of people have sent Ruthie there, or Herbert Harrigan there. You know, they've got Brianna Stewart and Natasha Howard at the peak of their powers, all WNBA players as the 4-5. They have Mercedes Russell, you know, it's kind of the bigger five for them. And then they have Morgan Tuck, who they just, in a way, they kind of box themselves in with that, where she's going to be the backup four. And then they've got Ezzy Magbegor, who they picked in the first round last year, an international player who might come over. So it's, I think sometimes that piece of it kind of gets left out, where it's just, it's not necessarily knocking, you know, in this case, Ruthie Hebert. It's just, you know, I think there might be teams you would rather want to see her go to further down that have, you know, there's better odds to make the roster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lots of, again, like we've said a couple times, there's a lot of different interesting pieces that come to play in these three rounds that we're going to see on Friday. Again, you can see Ben's article. He's got 2020 NBA Draft Central. He's got that top 36 draft board. He's got his mock draft over at B-Ball Index. That's bball-index.com, or you can find the site on Twitter at @bball_index. Or I'm sorry, it's @the_bball_index. Ben, anything else that you would like to plug before we head out of here?
One, of course, watch the draft. And two, actually, I wanted to bring up to your tanking point, kind of jokingly, because obviously I said I don't think it'll happen, but to also kind of weave this in with the college game and maybe help point people towards somebody to watch. Ryan Howard, go watch Kentucky these next 2 years. She's a sophomore, so she would be, you know, in the 2022 draft. She is an unbelievable basketball player. She's 6'1", so, you know, she's bigger than pretty much every small forward in the league. And she's like, I mean, you know, she's an unbelievable ball handler, gets to the rim, you know, just like can hit the step back three. Like, she has every single thing already. Yeah, she has every single tool already. So, you know, if it were to happen, you know, maybe a team does approach these next couple of years with an eye on 2022, but also just, you know, that's a player to watch that's coming up. And just, again, hopefully, the calendar is very friendly if you're going to watch the WNBA in the summer and then watch roll right into the college season. Ryan Howard at Kentucky is somebody for newer fans to pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. Gonna definitely keep an eye on that. And like you said, it's usually perfect timing with the calendar to have WNBA right in the summer when a lot of the other sports are dying down and we're thirsting for some of that good basketball. So hopefully we're able to get back to some kind of normal in the next couple months so we still get a season. Thank you again, Ben, for joining us. You can see Ben over at Twitter. His handle is @Ben_Dull, D-U-L-L. You can find the site at the_bball_index. I'm Tim_MBA. Lots of underscores in here, but lots of good content, hopefully. Again, Ben, thank you for joining us. And this episode of the B-Ball Index podcast has been brought to you through the Blue Wire Podcasting Network and our sponsor, betonline.ag. So thanks again, and everybody go watch that draft on Friday, and we'll hopefully be back to talk about some of our big takeaways in the future, because there's still no sports, but you're going to have lots of good content coming out of that draft when it comes to, you know, who is a good fit, who might not be a good fit, what some of the roster decisions teams might have to make might be, you know, all kinds of different things. So thank you again, Ben. Thanks to the listeners, and stay safe out there, everybody.